My name is Ed Goldberg. I'm the one making all the noise, and I have the pleasure of talking to Ken Rieger. Ken, welcome to Portland. Welcome to KABU.
Thank you.
Title of your book is The Girl on the Bridge. It's published by Aventine Press. Where can we get this book?
The book, there's a company, a local company, called Canubi Projects, and you can get it there. I'll leave a card, and maybe you can use it later. I don't have one.
Well, you got a website, maybe, or some?
It can be purchased on Aventine's website or Amazon.com.
Okay.
It can be purchased on any of those.
It's let me spell the name of the publisher then. Aventine Press, Aventine. Aventine Press.
That's it. They're out of San Diego.
Okay. I know. I've been there. The Girl on the Bridge is a book about a man named Kevin Edwards. Kevin Edwards is a Vietnam vet. When we meet him, it's more or less modern times. He's a fairly successful and stable guy. He's an administrator of a hospital. He's a civic leader in his little town. What's the name of the town? I forget.
The little town is not Willis, but Elwood.
Elwood.
Elwood in Missouri.
Yes. There's also a Toro and a whole bunch of other little towns. Well, are any of those towns real, or are they out of your imagination?
None of the towns are real, but the area is north central Missouri, which is used fictitiously, so it would be somewhere between Kansas City and Kirksville.
Okay.
There are a number of little towns there, but none of those used in the names used here are they're all fictitious.
No, the best reason to make up a town is that nobody can tell you got the name of the streets wrong.
That's correct.
Yes. He's in a marriage which is more or less, it seems like, a marriage of habit, that doesn't seem a particularly warm marriage.
That would be correct. And his wife is engaged in a number of other activities and has very little time for him.
Mm-hmm. In his duties as a civic leader, he's trying to bring some industry into the town. It's economically depressed, like a lot of rural America is. And the reason I ask that about thing specifically is that your character feels that his civic responsibility in some way grows out of his larger sense of responsibility. Is that a fair statement?
I think that is. I think that he sees him. He's really caught in a dilemma here, because the country does need to be economically stimulated in some way, but at the same time he has a big suspicion of corporate entities and the way they deal with little towns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He gets a message from Cherokee Irons. I don't remember exactly how the message came out. It's been a while since I read the book. But he gets a message from Cherokee Irons, and that kind of snaps his head around. Tell us a little bit about Cherokee Irons.
Okay, he gets a telephone call which indicates to the reader, although it isn't specifically presented, but it indicates to the reader that he has had a relationship with her some time ago and that a son has resulted, and that she is off in New York, he's in Missouri, married to another woman, and so the reader has to wonder, and he's obviously very much in love with her and him, but the reader has to wonder, why is he married to this woman instead of that woman? And so it's a kind of a trick we have as authors to keep people turning the pages.
Right.
At that point, she is simply a girl from his past to whom he has a child with, and the child has a problem that needs his assistance, and so she is coming back and is going to talk to him about it.
Mm-hmm. And he doesn't tell his wife about this, so he contrives to meet her on the sneak. He doesn't even tell his secretary about it, because he thinks his secretary is a spy for his wife.
That's exactly right, and it's interesting, I think, the way that he pursues that. He talks to his wife, and as we read it, we are entertained with what he's thinking at the same time as what he's saying. And we realize in that, I think, that he's trying to manipulate her, and she responds in the way that he knows she will. Oh, I'm sorry, I can't go. I have this meeting with the club or something other, and he knows that. And so he says, well, I guess I'll just have to go myself, by myself, which is what he wants all along, is so he can get away and see Cherokee Iron.
Mm-hmm. This story has three layers, for want of a better
exactly
term.
Right.
Vietnam in 1965.
Yes.
Missouri shortly thereafter,
right.
And modern times when we first meet Kevin.
That's exactly right.
Cherokee is maybe the love of his life, definitely the love of his life,
yes.
And he has nothing but warm regard and memories of her, but she also is a kind of a if he goes back past her, he had his unhappy experience in Vietnam, and in some way, the two of them really connected. Because when we meet him in his earlier incarnation, he's a medicated, disturbed Vietnam vet. Can you talk a little bit about that?
He's almost he is suicidal, and he's taken medication from the VA. And he's having flashbacks, but his memory is not well. But he's having these little flashbacks, and he doesn't know exactly what they are. And he's totally depressed. And then he meets Cherokee Irons, and she becomes in a way his savior, because he sees some brightness in the world that had been dark before that. And he's also having some problems with impotency, and so he determines, rightly, that the medicine he's getting from the VA is responsible for that. And so he kind of quits taking it. And when he does, not only does his potency come back, but also a memory begins to come back from Vietnam that he had kind of forgotten. And he determined that the VA medicine was a part of a vast conspiracy to cause him to actually lose his memory. And so he begins to regain his memory, so the novel becomes, at that point, a journey of self-discovery, because he begins to discover who he is. And he and Cherokee Irons then set out on an odyssey to find the parents of his lost friend who was killed in Vietnam. And on the way, he's discovering himself. They're discovering each other. Because of this, and some other things that I don't want to ruin it for the reader,
right,
that there are some reasons that some very bad people have to stop him. They have to stop him to protect themselves, and he has to find an FBI agent in Kansas City, an individual, and so there becomes then the chase. Who's going to catch who first? And they're making a run for it. And so in that sense, it becomes what I always think is a great way to write a novel, is that you have little people caught up in big things, and not their own making, but there they are. Mm-hmm. And so what do they do? And so it becomes that.
It's almost every movie Hitchcock ever made was that. An ordinary guy and throwing him way over his head and seeing what happens to him.
That's right. And this is what happens to them. And again, it becomes, I've been told that it was really a page turner. In fact, Bill Duncan down at Roadburg here in Oregon wrote me a letter, and he had written a review. And he referred to me as the master of the flashback, because it does, it flashes back from modern to 67, and then the 67 people flash back to 65. And so, but it all, according to Duncan, works.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the last chapter, if you've read it, you know that changes everything.
It does, doesn't it? I don't want to talk about that at all. It occurs to me that his impotency is almost a metaphor in this case, because he feels impotent in other ways in his life as well. I mean, that's just simply the most obvious example of ways that he has suppressed things that have caused him to feel like a non-existent person. I don't know exactly quite how to put it. An unimportant, a person with no power or personal integrity.
It's interesting that the same time that he's a hospital administrator was when Jesse Jackson first appeared on the political scene. And Jesse Jackson had a set political speech in which he said, "I'm somebody."
Mm-hmm.
And so I think Kevin Edwards had lost out on who he really is. He didn't know he didn't know who he was. And I think that's, and there are many metaphors in Girl on the Bridge, and it's interesting that you pick up those, because we have people who don't pick up any metaphors and they read the surface story. They're literalists. And then you have others who see the figurative things and the metaphorical stuff, and they see all of that. And so I like to think it's complicated, because some of those things I thought about when I was writing it, creating metaphors, the names of towns, Kevin Edwards' name itself is a kind of, can be thought of more. And Cherokee Irons and her comparison with Ellen Edwards, the wife, they're both beautiful. But you see, Ellen Edwards is beautiful, the kind of beauty, I think it says in the book, that comes with having everything in place.
Mm-hmm.
And Cherokee Irons, though, has a she's beautiful in a wildness, natural sort of way. And so you have this naturalness juxtaposed with the beauty of having everything in place. And so there's that kind of play too going on here. And there's much more of that. The bridge itself, the girl on the bridge, which is not, there is an actual bridge in the novel, mm-hmm. but more than that, I think, 1967 is the bridge in Kevin Edwards' life. The time before that is one thing, and afterward it's completely different. And mm-hmm. so that bridge, and she is on that bridge as he makes that thing. And this particular bridge has a wild area on one side called Little Egypt, and on the other side is the highway and the civilization and all of that. So it's a bridge between Cherokee Irons and Ellen Edwards in a way, too. So there's a lot of that woven in there, metaphors and things.
When you planned out this novel, I don't know whether you outlined it meticulously or whether you just sat down and let it come. Well, when you were planning this novel, had all these things been in place, or did some of them just pop up as you were writing?
I do programs on this, and I'm going to be doing one Friday, if I can say that, at the Pendarvis Farm, which is around here somewhere. I have no idea.
Well, that's true, but by the time people hear this, it'll be long past, I'm afraid. I'm sorry.
But I was going to say, I'm sorry, I lost the question there.
The question was, did you meticulously plan out this novel, or were you able to allow things to pop up that
as I tell people, what I do, I think everyone has a novel in them. I do think that. And what I did with this one, I felt this novel kind of thing, and I created the characters from their composites and things, and I created these characters, and then I just every day I would go down and sit down and start writing, and I would write what I saw with my inner eyes. These characters acted out their character, and I watched them do that, and so it just kind of became what it became. So there it was. Now I would not suggest to anyone that's the way to write a novel. People talk about outlining and all that. I didn't do any of that. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of this hit the cutting room floor, to use a movie metaphor. A lot of it just hit the cutting room floor. I think it's ended up 325 pages, and it was probably at one time 600-700. Mm-hmm. It just ended up there, and I'm lucky enough to get a good editor, and she made it better. She made it a lot better. But to answer your question specifically, I would say this is more of one that just flowed. The characters were created, and then I let them be their character, and someone criticized me because I don't think it's full of a lot of vulgarity, but there is some. Soldiers just talk like soldiers talk.
Right.
And someone, one of my close friends, said, I don't see why you had to do that. And I said, well, I didn't do it. The characters said that, and
good
I just
answer.
Simply put down what they said, and I would be dishonest if I said they didn't say that, so I just tried to be honest. But I think there's not a lot of that. It's not put in just for its own sake, I would say.
Well, I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Ken Rieger, R-E-G-E-R. The title of his novel is The Girl on the Bridge, published by Aventine Press. Yeah, somebody, a sculptor once told me, when I asked what the process was of becoming a sculptor, he says, I just get a block of wood and cut away everything that doesn't look like a piece of art. So, I mean, maybe that's what happens here, too. It's not really a major theme in the book, but it's one that was important to me, was the treatment of vets when they come back from service. Now, do you have any personal experience with that? I guess I need to ask you that.
I do. I don't want to say that I had an experience like Kevin Edwards, because I didn't. Uh-huh. I am a Vietnam era veteran. I was not in Vietnam.
You were not in country.
I was in the service at that time.
Right.
So I know how veterans feel. And to tell you the truth, to be real honest, and a lot of the things in here comes from that experience, is when I came home, I was angry. I was very angry for maybe as long as 5 years. And my very early marriage that I had as a teenager was destroyed in the process, because I was just a very angry man. And then I felt like I had been had by my government. And I had grown up, as it says in here, with the flag behind the teacher at the school and the Pledge of Allegiance and all of that. And
as
I thought I had a duty.
Yeah.
And I went, and I was told that everyone had a duty. And then I came back, and in my senior class, I was the only one that went into service at that time. So somebody lied to me. And that wasn't the only one. But so I was very angry. And then when I came back, as again, there's a little piece in there where he sits at the he goes to the restaurant when he comes back to his little town, and then one of his old buddies comes up and says, "Where have you been? I haven't seen you for a while." And he says, "Well, I've been in service." And he says, "Oh, really? Well, I've been gone myself. I was with the hay harvest," you know, and all this stuff. And it was almost like that was equal, and he didn't want it to be that way. This has been a very special thing that I've served the country, and I put my life in danger, and I lost a good friend. And then you act like it's just the same thing as going with the wheat harvest, and it's not that.
That's a nice piece of irony. I like that.
And so I saw things like that. And so then when I came back, not only was I angry because of my service situation, I came back, and then the way that I was treated when I came back. My little hometown was kind of like Willis, Missouri here in this book. It's 400 or 500 people, and everyone knew me. And I expected this, you know, some pats on the back at the very least, or maybe, here, let me buy you a beer or something. Mm-hmm. But I didn't get anything. It was just as if, for them, there wasn't anything going on.
Well, it's kind of interesting because, you know, I was in New York at the time, and everybody expects New Yorkers to be blasé or too left-wing or whatever the rap on New Yorkers is. And I think that veterans, none of the Vietnam vets really got it, the kind of welcome they deserve coming back. But it occurs to me that even in New York, they got treated better than you got treated.
I think in many ways, there were people who were treated, I've been told, that people were spit on and were, they yelled things at them and things like that. Well, that's one thing, but at least it's overt.
Mm-hmm.
This was just as if nothing's going on. And there's a little thing on the back of the book, a little paragraph about this little town. It says that in little towns, everybody knows everybody and everything about everybody. And it was like that in Willis, except everybody had a secret. And the secret, which nobody talked about, was what was going on in Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like indifference is even worse than...
I think it
yeah,
is.
That's
I think
worst
the
thing.
Result of it is different. It's a lot worse.
Mm-hmm. I have a note here that says personal issues versus public ideas. And I think what I meant by that is Edwards has decisions to make, decisions that are moral decisions. And he has the reason that it's hard for him to do is because there's resistance. And people know that he may be making decisions like this, and they're resisting that thing. So when you say you're angry at your government, I think it's manifested here in the actions of a couple of characters. Did you personalize it like that?
I didn't, but as I tell people along, and other people have seen things not exactly like that, but things similar to that. And as I said, people always ask me, is this a story of your life? Is this a mm-hmm. autobiography put behind it? And it isn't. But at the same time, a writer writes from his own experiences. And when he writes emotion into a novel, as good novels do have emotions in them, it becomes the author's emotions. You can't write someone else's emotions. And you can't write from someone else's experience. And so I suspect, although I didn't intentionally do it, but I would suspect, since I was acting out my own character as the author, I suspect some of that did find its way in there. And what you've just expressed is something that I have characterized myself that way sometimes.
There's also, a lot of this book is about the power of love. And I think that's really what the central, if there's a core to the book, I mean, that's certainly what I got out of it, that love has a redeeming and healing power to it. Would you like to talk about that?
I would, and I'm glad you saw that, because I did intend that, because I feel it very strongly. I know how I felt when I came back. I was an angry man, and I know what got me past that. And I've had other crises in my life that love has carried me through that. And so I think love does have that. And there's a situation in here, a place where they're walking down a ridge, he and Cherokee Irons, and he's going to see this parent their son was his buddy who got killed. And he begins to see things that he hasn't seen before. He sees blooms on flowers, and he sees different things like that. And then at the end of that chapter, it says, with her beside him, on that day, he saw things that only poets see. And I once tried to be a poet, and you can't try to be something like that. You either are or you're not. You either see things like poets see or you don't.
I'm willing to bet that my poetry is worse than yours. So.
but to answer your question, yes, love has a redeeming quality, and I did specifically write that because I wanted it to be that. I wanted it to be it all comes out good in the end. And even though the end may not be totally to everyone's satisfaction, I think if they think about it, it will be, because it is that love endures. Even in the worst circumstances, love does endure. The love he had for Showalter, his friend, who he remembers from Vietnam, and the love he has for Cherokee Irons, and the love he had actually for this girl in Vietnam who was killed. Her name is Lay.
Mm-hmm.
And I even at once wrote a little sequel to this was about her, but it went down on the floor too. love is a, has a, I'm glad you picked up on that, because that is one of the major themes. I think this, if people ask me, I'd say that it is a love story. That's what it is. But of course, it's other things too. But I think it's a love story. It's what it is.
Yeah, at base, it really is. I was thinking, when he meets Cherokee, he has a crummy little job in a baby food factory, which you described in such detail, I thought maybe this guy must have once worked in a baby food factory.
I didn't work in a baby food factory, but I did one time for a winter. I worked in a food processing place that was, I can't think of the name of the company, but they eventually were sold out to Farmland Industries. But it was a lead. They produced all kinds of food. But what I liked there, again, was the metaphor things of the little baby food jars going down the conveyors. And then he goes out at one point and he sees the people in intersections, and all the cars moving, and he sees them all together, and he sees them, they're just like the baby food things. It's people all bouncing along, and everybody's in such a wild hurry. And they're really not going anywhere. I mean, it's preconceived where they're going. They're going to be there, so just take your time. And why do you have to be in such a hurry? But everybody's in a hurry, and he sees all of that. And so that baby food factory then becomes another metaphor. It becomes a metaphor for the humdrum, fast move, synthetic, really, culturally synthetic atmosphere in this little town.
And yet it does help Edwards cope a little bit also. The fact that he can get outside himself a little bit, he's drugged for one thing, but right. Also the fact that he's able to get into this tedious work and exist on a day-to-day level, at least function, right. Also seems to be important.
Yes, and you know, we all fit in some way that way. You know, I'm thinking of your job, you know, here you are, you come in, you do this kind of thing. And it's a part of a complex of which you're just some little part of it.
I'm just a little cog. Yeah.
And most of us are that way. We're not in charge. You know, and at one point they go to a party, you remember, and then again the metaphor, there's this huge party going on, these people, and he says, who's in charge here? It's at an old house out in the country. And she said, I don't know. I don't think anybody's in charge. And that's a good question to ask of the entire American culture. I mean, our American nation, who's in charge here? And basically, the answer is nobody. Nobody's in charge. It just goes on. Or like your guy Ken Kesey, who has this nut house, which is really America. It's just all a big nut house. I thought about that, but he does manage to function there, mm-hmm. and he meets her though. He sees her across the way, and I got a letter from a Marine veteran in Idaho. He called me on the phone. He'd picked it up from Amazon.com, and he'd read it, and he called me about it. And that's what he liked more than anything. He said it was like when he met his wife. It was all this darkness and bland and everything, and then Cherokee Irons, she didn't blend in. And she was like a rose in all this muck and stuff out there. And that's what he said. He saw his wife, and he really liked that section. But the factory does serve that way.
He, in fact, she works for a supervisor who considers him, she calls Edwards the mystery man,
yes.
Because he's so closed in, you know, he's so protective of his own ego that I think maybe piques her interest a little bit in him, you know, because she feels like an outsider as well.
I think so. He sees her as a mystery also. Her mm-hmm. smile is mysterious. And all of these things, so she is very attractive to him. But this other woman, Sylvia Spencer is her name, she works in there, and she razzes him and stuff, you know, the mystery man and all this stuff. And Cherokee Irons, she kind of calls him out, you know, the mystery man, and he said, no, I'm not a mystery man, I'm just who I am. But he is that way. He's closed in. He doesn't have a lot of friends. I don't know that he has any friends there. And he eats lunch by himself, remember, and he doesn't have anything to do with him. But then she comes and breaks through that shell, either because of who she is or he thought it was kind of faithful. You know, he looks through the glass at her when she's coming in, and he sees her, and he's drawn to her. And at the same time, he sees a reflection of himself on the glass. So he's seeing himself at the same time that he sees her. So he sees something of himself in her. And I think that's, at least this is my own opinion, that I think that's what happens when someone says, I'm attracted to this woman, or the woman says, I'm attracted to this man. I think because there's always something missing in your life if you don't have another person. And then when you see that part that's missing in yourself in this other person. And at least that's what I thought when I wrote that.
We have about a minute left. What are you working on now?
I'm working on another book that's going to be called, tentatively titled, The Girl on the Run. But it's not a sequel to this. It's about an interesting project that I ran onto in some of my research, that there is a possibility in the next few years, if we don't already have it, that there will be, that the possibility of a computer brain interface, that you can actually interface a brain, human brain, with a computer and manipulate the behavior of that person from your headquarters with your keyboard.
Scary stuff.
That's scary stuff. And some of the very same people that Kevin Edwards found himself up against were involved in this kind of stuff. So I'm letting my brain run wild, and it'll be a love story as well. So
it's fun stuff to let your imagination go, isn't it?
And it's something to do. I'm an older man, and it's something to do other than watch soaps or walk down to the courthouse and sit and, you know, and talk to the other guys in the shade.
Hey, I'm not just reading a book; I'm writing one.
Yeah, right.
It's been fun talking to you. I've been speaking with Ken Rieger, R-E-G-E-R. The title of his book is "The Girl on the Bridge," published by Aventine Press. Ken, when your science fiction love story comes out, we'd really like to see you back here.
Okay, I'll do it. And again, it's Ruby Kashaw Allen. She lives on 162nd Street.
Oh, you don't want to tell anybody where she lives.
Anyway, she has them, and she'll know about me because she's my agent here in the Northwest.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming.
Okay, you're welcome.